And the court will proceed to the third case, Navarro versus Neal. Mr. Ratchowitz?
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This is a simple case. It poses essentially one substantial issue. It raises the question, must a state have a rational basis for further limiting ballot access, or can the state pose as a reasoning just any old thing? Now, the rational basis test requires three things. There, of course, must be a law in question. The state must have a legitimate interest for that law. And there must actually be a rational relationship between the stated interest and the law. Where courts have found that the facts do not actually support that relationship, they've overturned such laws. For example, the U.S. Supreme Court did so in Romer versus Evans and in City of Claiborne versus Claiborne Living Center. The Sixth Circuit also did so in Craig Miles versus Giles. As a matter of fact, no circuit court has ever held, as the state now asks this court to do, that that relationship should be waived, that substantiating that relationship is not actually a requirement of the rational basis test.
Why are you arguing this under the rational basis test? You're the plaintiff here. You want higher scrutiny, right? And the rational basis test doesn't apply in the elections law context. This is not strict scrutiny, clearly, because it's not a bar to ballot access completely. It's a regulatory requirement. You've got to get a certain number of signatures. So it's sort of an intermediate sliding scale standard. It's not the rational basis standard.
I will not dispute applying a higher standard. If a higher standard is applied, the state has offered no reasoning higher than a simple legitimate interest. This court...
There's lots and lots of case law that says that a state has an important interest. Forget about legitimate. Has an important interest in controlling ballot access and limiting it to serious candidates.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very minimal signature requirement, 500 signatures for a state assembly candidate and 1,000 signatures for a state senate candidate in 75 days. That's eminently doable for any serious candidate, and your folks wouldn't do it.
But even then, Your Honor, there's simply no rationale for imposing that standard.
We've already said that signature requirements are more than rational and more than reasonable, more than legitimate. They are important to the state's interest in controlling ballot access for only serious candidates.
But, Your Honor, it's not simply the signature requirement, and that's not the interest the state offered. The state offered the interest in preventing ballots from the traditional, preventing ballots from being the size of a telephone book, so that voters are unable to make a rational choice because there's so many candidates they can't review them. What we're talking about are elections in which there's only one candidate. We're not talking about a requirement to prevent the ballots from being overstuffed. We're talking about a requirement that prevents ballots from essentially being ballots. I mean, an election is supposed to presuppose that there's more than one candidate, that voters have a choice.
But that one candidate had to get those 500 signatures to become the candidate. So why?
Well, in this
why
case,
is that unfair that that?
Well, in this case, there was an alternate method for establishing that a candidate's a serious candidate, and that is that they are the candidate supported by one of the major parties. What this law changes, it says, whereas before you're a serious candidate if you get 500 signatures. Or if you are the backed, proposed, vetted candidate of one of the two major parties, now we're no longer going to trust the major parties, and we're only going to do it the one way. And the problem is, in many districts throughout the state, only one of those parties has a stranglehold on that district, which means in those districts...
You can't find 500 Republicans in Cook County?
Not in each of those districts. Not who's willing to put their name on a signature and discover that their trash isn't being hauled up, that inspectors are coming by and citing them for fines. It's not a question of finding 500 Republicans or in other districts, finding 500 Democrats. The question is finding 500 people who are willing to subject themselves to the wrath of the ruling party in their district. That is the issue, and that is why, at one point, the state in its wisdom allowed the parties to vet and pick candidates. Your Honor, in discussing this bill, the state legislature was very clear. It's not about one party or the other. These were incumbents who very brazenly said, we have to control these challengers, these people trying to challenge us at the ballot. That's what the state legislator, was their discussion.
I recognize that this was resolved at a very early stage in the litigation. But do you have anything to support the proposition that this actually shuts down all opposition in a critical mass of assembly districts and Senate districts across the state of Illinois?
Yes, the state legislature recognized that fewer than half of legislative districts are contested.
That's where are we going to find that?
That was in the legislative record. The state legislator said that. I mean, they took notice of that fact.
I take it that was something coming from the opposition Republicans arguing against this requirement?
That was openly discussed by the state legislator when they were discussing this.
And
this
that's
bill.
The status quo that they wanted to maintain by changing the system. Is that the argument?
They were trying to further limit access from that. So they wanted to go from a situation where less than half of incumbents could be challenged to they wanted, I guess, even fewer. Maybe they wanted no incumbents to be challenged. I do believe that one of the issues the court needs to ask is how far can a state go in limiting ballot access? I mean, doesn't the state also have a legitimate and important interest in holding elections that are real elections, meaning somebody running for office runs against somebody? Isn't really the state's interest in this in ensuring that voters have a choice between at least two candidates? If the status quo is that voters do not have a choice or they have a choice less than half the time, then there just can be no justification for further limiting ballot access.
Do you want to speak to the other part of this case where the judge said you slept on your rights, Mr. Reddick?
Yes, Your Honor. That may be so in seeking injunctive relief, because one of the elements of latches is that it's not simply a timing issue. It's that the timing imposes some undue hardship on the state. Now, we're not seeking injunctive relief anymore. We're seeking declaratory relief. And it simply cannot be said that a declaration that the state no longer has to enforce an unconstitutional law is a hardship on the state. In fact, it is a burden on the state to enforce an unconstitutional law. And so what we're seeking is not a burden. We're actually seeking to liberate the state from that burden. The elements of latches are simply not met in this case.
You want to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Scanlon?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, James Scanlon, on behalf of the Appellees. If I might first address the issue about latches. Clearly, the plaintiffs in this case slept on their rights. The board's decision removing the plaintiff candidates from the ballot occurred on July 13th. The plaintiffs waited one day less than 10 weeks to file their complaint on September 20th, preceding the November 6th general election. they really haven't come forward with any excusable delay or cause for delay in this case.
I understand with respect to that general election, but in terms of the law itself, why would latches prevent them from seeking a declaration about the effect of the statute?
Well, Your Honor, I think this case is very, very similar to this Court's decision in the Filani case, Filani versus Hogshead, which we cited in our brief. It's a 1990 case. That case also was a case where the plaintiffs brought a complaint for declaratory judgment, injunctive relief, and money damages. The Court there said that since the plaintiffs in that case had waited 11 weeks to file their complaint, they had slept on their rights.
But there isn't much discussion in the Filani decision about latches with respect to the declaratory part of that suit.
Well, I think that this Court was very clear in that case that having slept on their rights, it was fatal to any relief. Any relief. And it did.
Why is that as to the statute going forward beyond the immediate election?
Well, because I think that the equitable maxim, if you sleep on your rights, you lose them. And you don't lose some of your rights. Courts have generally said you lose all of your rights because you waited too long to press your case. And I think the courts are also clear in the context of elections, such claims must be pressed expeditiously. And this case is certainly no exception.
Certainly a claim for injunctive relief to restore someone to the ballot must, that's the sort of claim that has to be pressed very expeditiously, as you point out, and as the Filani case held. But I think the analysis must be more nuanced than that in the case of a generalized claim for declaratory injunction, declaratory relief against the statute that's alleged to be unconstitutional. Otherwise, a freestanding claim for declaratory relief that has nothing to do with the timing of a particular election couldn't proceed. So the statement that you've relied on from the Filani case seems to me considerably overbroad.
Well, Your Honor, and I believe that Filani was also a case, as I said earlier, that brought a declaratory judgment claim.
Why does that make any sense? To the extent that the Filani case stands for the proposition that the entire claim, injunctive relief having to do with the specific ballot in question, and the declaratory claim against the law in general is barred. Why does that make any sense?
Well, again, I think, Your Honor, it's consistent with the equitable maximum. If you sleep in your rights, you lose them.
Your right to get restored to the ballot, granted, you would lose that if you wait too long. But your right to argue that the statute is unconstitutional, waiting 2 months is hardly too long to bring that sort of a claim, a general claim, not I want restoration to the ballot, but I want the court to consider my argument that the statute is unconstitutional.
Well,
2 months is not a very long time for that sort of a claim.
But, again, in the context of elections, it's a lifetime, not
but
a lifetime.
But it's not election-specific.
With respect to one election, it is, but that law stays in place for all future elections, and so having been a little slow on the one particular election, they lose all their rights?
Well, again, Your Honor, in the Filani case, there was some discussion about the fact that the case was not moot, because that was one of the issues that was claimed in that case. And this Court said in that case those claims were not moot because there were live controversies with respect to the declaratory judgment and the money damage claims. So the Court was clear in Filani that the case was not moot and the case should not have been dismissed on any claims of mootness. But I think it was equally clear that because the plaintiffs had slept on their rights, they lost all of their rights, including the declaratory judgment and the money damage claim.
So if the latches reasoning used by the district judge here is to be upheld, it's going to depend on the Filani case?
I believe that is the strongest case. I think there's the Kay versus Austin as well. Your Honor, then if I could also address the constitutional issues. I think that as Judge Sykes has pointed out, the signature requirement here was eminently doable. I think that the plaintiff's chief argument is that in this case there was no issue of overcrowding on the ballot, because essentially in these particular, in these six districts which were involved in this case, there was only one candidate on the ballot, and that was the Democratic ballot, or Democratic candidate, excuse me. But overcrowding is not the only legitimate objective, or preventing overcrowding is not the only legitimate objective served by a signature requirement rule. I think the court in Bullock versus Carter outlined at least three objectives that are served by regulating the number of candidates on the ballot. Number one, it prevents clogging of the election machinery. Number two, it avoids voter confusion. Number three, it assures that the winner of the election wins by a majority, or at least a strong plurality of the votes, which avoids the expensive burden of possible runoff elections. And fourth, and perhaps most importantly, it protects the integrity of the political process from frivolous or fraudulent candidacies.
Well, the first three interests are not implicated here.
But I believe that, if nothing else, the fourth interest is. And the Supreme Court in Storr versus Brown was clear that the state not only has an interest, it has a duty to protect the integrity of the political process from frivolous or fraudulent candidacies. And these courts have recognized that with unmistakable clarity, states have an undoubted right to require candidates to show a preliminary showing of substantial support in order to qualify for the ballot. In this case, there was an insufficient showing of voter support as a precondition for getting on the ballot. Now, the plaintiffs claim that, well, and they go back to their argument, there was no overcrowding here. And that may be true in this particular case.
Well, it's not true at all in this context.
That's correct. That's correct.
The statute just doesn't go to that concern.
That's correct. And the
it also doesn't go to the concern of fraud.
Well, frivolous and fraudulent are the terms that are used
together. This is not a question of fraud.
No, I'm not arguing that in this case there's any fraudulent candidacies. I think the question is
not just in this case, but in general. This requirement doesn't have anything to do with a problem of fraud in ballot accessing.
Well,
I don't know. I assume it goes to, the legislative record will support that, it goes to this idea of wanting serious candidates who have some electoral support, some minimal degree of electoral support, to be on the ballot. So it's the frivolousness argument.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and that was the reason for the amendments, the 2010 amendments, was to assure that these candidates had some basic grassroots support to demonstrate that they had some, that they were serious candidates and that they had a right to have access to the ballot. And we're not talking, again, in this particular case, although I think there are instances where the minimum signature requirement can
How many Assembly and Senate districts are uncontested? Or let's talk about in recent history. How many Assembly candidates have no opposition and Senate candidates have no opposition historically in the last 10 years?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I don't know. I do not have that data in front of me, and it was not certainly in the record.
Well, this was a dismissal on the pleadings.
Right.
I assume that's public record somewhere, right?
It can be gleaned from the public records. That's correct. In this case, the plaintiffs claim that these six races, there are three Senate races, three state rep races, these were the only, if I recall correctly, these were the only legislative races where there was no contest between the Democrat and Republican. They allude to the fact that there is some discussion in the legislative debate that half of all of the legislative districts in the state of Illinois are uncontested. That, I should point out, was a remark made by someone who initially opposed the bill.
Right. I would imagine that that's where that would come from.
And they were concerned when the bill was originally introduced, the signature requirement was the same as the signature requirement for independent candidates, which at that time was significantly higher than the signature requirement for getting on a primary ballot. Right. And the remarks were made by an individual who opposed the bill, largely because of that higher signature requirement. Ultimately, the signature requirement was amended to bring it down and make it the same as a signature requirement for anyone trying to get on the primary ballot. So that's where that remark comes from. There's no statistical data that's been offered by the plaintiffs. Nothing in the record to show that, in fact, is the case. And, Your Honor, I see my time has expired. Thank you very much, Your Honor. We ask the court affirm the district court.
Your Honors, very quickly, I would like to address two things. The first is the latches argument, and I want to point out this is now a case only for declaratory relief. Had the appellants waited until the day after the election and filed a case at trial seeking only declaratory relief, it would be clear that latches was not relevant because, again, the elements are not met. There is no undue burden on the state by the timing. If anything, the state is benefited because it no longer has to enforce an unconstitutional law. And I think that Filani's not quite on par for this case because it deals with a claim where declaratory relief was mingled with injunctive and monetary damages, whereas we are only talking about declaratory relief. Secondly, I want to point to the merits of the case. I do agree that what we're talking about is a law that purports to uphold the integrity by preventing frivolous candidates. But here's a problem in that analysis. It may be correct, it may not, but at this point, we haven't had the opportunity to look at the facts. For example, if we say, well, 500 requirements is, that seems like there should be 500 Republicans, or it seems like that shouldn't be a problem, that's a conclusion based on more facts than we have. Is it true that all the Republicans in one of these districts or any member of a party, a minority party in a district so completely controlled by the other party, is it true that they don't exist, or is it true that they would be intimidated to come out publicly by signing a candidate statement? If that's the case, then the original law is a very good law because it allows the party to step in.
Do you know the answer to my question to your opposing counsel about how many Senate and how many House or Assembly, I'm not sure what it's called in Illinois, candidates run?
I believe, I don't know the breakdown, but the number 55% are unopposed. But I do believe that is a fact that's relevant to this case that should come out in trial. And that's the reason that this should not have been dismissed on a procedural grounds, that it should go, at the very least, go back to trial, and we should uncover those facts. We should have a hearing and determine what those facts are. And the conclusions in this case require those facts. Is it, again, 500 signatures doesn't sound like a lot when you just say the number 500 in a whole Senate or House race, unless there's so much intimidation, justified or not, but real intimidation, that you're not going to be able to find 500 people willing to stand up. In that case, we have a two-party system, and part of the benefits of that is that one party can put up a candidate.
You don't question that the Supreme Court of both the state of Illinois and the United States Supreme Court has sanctioned this kind of requirement of minimum signatures, do you?
Not this kind. I agree that the courts have sanctioned signature requirements, but that doesn't necessarily make it relevant in this particular case. Again, we're not talking about a signature, just a straight signature requirement. We're talking about changing a system where you could either have a signature requirement or party leaders could pick a candidate where to avoid, for example, the threat of or the situation where you might have an intimidated populace who's not willing to stand up. We're not talking about imposing a signature requirement. We're talking about changing a requirement of either signatures or another valid method of determining a candidate are legitimate or have some validity.
What would be that valid alternative?
Again, the party apparatus. I mean, we assume party leaders know where they want to expend resources and that they wouldn't simply put their resources on a candidate that where there was no reason to do so. I mean, again,
it's a more democratic approach than having 500 or 1,000 citizens assemble by request of an individual candidate.
If the situation is that everyone is so intimidated that 500 people are not willing to stand up and identify themselves to have their garbage not picked up or to have city inspectors come by and start writing fines for whatever, then it is a more democratic method.
Understood. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.